prior to joining defense, I viewed these opportunities more as technological opportunities and didn't spend a lot of time thinking about the social implications, but rather the technological promise. Today, I think my focus is almost totally directed at the social implications and how it can affect society, and having the technology, which I think I'm very strong in, sort of derive from that.
Cyberspace pioneer Robert Kahn, next on Soundings. Robert Kahn is here to talk about his groundbreaking work with computers and information technology. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to the Center's weekly radio magazine about books and ideas. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, created in 1989 to honor innovative uses of information technology that benefit society. In today's mass culture, driven by instant communications and global economies, the word pioneer sounds out of place, even quaint. But our world wouldn't be what it is without the pioneering efforts of Robert Kahn, one of the visionaries whose work led to the creation of the cyberspaces we inhabit. Robert Kahn is a founder of the Internet. After stints at Bell Laboratories and MIT, Kahn spent 13 years at the ARPA, or the Advanced Research Projects Agency, the government initiative that fostered the Internet and the World Wide Web. During a recent recording session at the Smithsonian Institution in the nation's capital, Bob Kahn reflected on his work as a cyberspace pioneer.
Well, the Internet came about in a gradual fashion. I think the word first appeared in the literature sometime in the mid-1970s. But when I actually began working on computer networking, we were focused more on the elements of networking. You know, how do you build a network that will let two computers communicate effectively? That was what packet switching technology was really all about. And my contribution to that was really understanding how to design a network that would communicate by allowing computers to take their data, break it into little chunks, packets we call them, which had addresses on them, like envelopes mailed through the postal system, send it through a network, relaying it from node to node until it got to its destination within a fraction of a second. And that kind of activity was really a marvelous one in terms of thinking through the pieces that might have to be invented to make a technology like that real. We were not thinking about internet at the time. We were thinking about computer-to-computer interaction as a technological challenge. But the second phase of that, which to me is the critical piece of the internet, was how do you make it possible for multiple networks to interact with each other and to let computers on different networks interact with each other without any central administration that oversees the individual networks themselves. This is what I've called open architecture networking, in the sense that there are defined interfaces, defined standards that allow for independent networks to plug together and for these computers to talk together without the need for any other intervention.
How did we move from thinking of the kind of work that you're describing, Bob Kahn, in terms of military defense work out into, again, larger sort of cultural applications, social applications? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, the internet really did come out of the defense world in the sense that it supported all the early work, but it was mainly at the level of creating the technology and understanding how it might be used. Clearly in the back of our minds was the potential for its utility in defense, but we also saw its utility more broadly for scientific research and social needs that go way beyond those. While defense was running the internet, as it were, there was really no opportunity for real commercialization. We just didn't allow that to happen. But in the mid-1980s, in fact, shortly after I left ARPA to start the organization that I now run, the Corporation for National Research Initiatives, or CNRI, the mantle was passed from ARPA to the National Science Foundation, which in fact took on this responsibility for networking to broaden the community of users from the narrow set of computer science users to the broader set of scientific and educational uses that they could foresee.
Did you have a proprietary sense? Was that a good thing or a bad thing that this your baby, so to speak, was moving beyond the walls of scientific academic research and out into the culture?
Oh no, I clearly thought that was an extremely important thing to do. It wasn't clear how it would happen within defense. The key people at NSF that enabled it were, one, Eric Block, who had recently joined as the director of the National Science Foundation and wanted the NSF to play that role, and some of the leadership within NSF under him. And I'm particularly thinking of people like Steve Wolf, who ran the office, the networking office there for a long time, and who tried to broaden the community of users out in a significant fashion, mm-hmm. as well as some people like Gordon Bell and Bill Wolf and others who were at a higher level in the organization and supported him seriously in doing that. I felt that the most critical thing by far was the decision by the Congress, led by, I think it was Rick Boucher, a congressman from Virginia, to allow NSF to take assets that it had deployed, government assets like the NSFNet, and enable commercial users to make use of it. In fact, my organization, CNRI, actually developed the first commercial application on the internet, and we had to get the government to approve us connecting to it. Mm-hmm. This was around 1989. It involved the connection of the MCI mail system to the internet. But to focus on the internet itself, which is really where the kind of leadership transition has occurred, it really was focused on the federal government in the early days. In fact, when the internet started, it was basically myself that played the role of leadership, management, and whatever. Uh-huh. And then I hired a fellow named Vint Cerf to come and work for me. He joined with me in actually doing the conceptual work on the internet in the early days. Vint joined me about 4 years into the program at ARPA, and together he and I played that role for a number of years. Somewhere along the way, I got very concerned that if something happened to Vint or myself, that nobody in the community would know what we were doing in terms of providing the leadership or why the decisions had been made. Mm-hmm. And so we set up, in fact, it reported to Vint at the time, something called the Internet Configuration Control Board, which was a set of people from the community who helped to work on the configuration of the internet, who understood the issues, who were part of the decision-making process on technical evolution. Mm-hmm. After Vint left ARPA to join MCI, I took over the program again and hired another fellow named Barry Liner to come in and take over the program. One of Barry's very first efforts was to recast the Configuration Control Board into something which he called the IAB, or Internet Activities Board. And this was a group that actually took the responsibility for leadership in this whole area. And that persisted from roughly the 1983 time frame through the end of the decade, or actually into the early 1990s, at which a whole different set of structures came into being. If you look at threads, there's a thread that's purely technological. And I think the key components of that are this notion of open architecture, which I would attribute to myself, the notion of the protocol suite to actually implement this, which is something I did jointly with a fellow named Vint Cerf, who I mentioned earlier, the idea of the layered protocols that might fall on top of that for various application purposes, for which there are many people whose names could be associated with that. You also have a community of use track, which really dates to the early days of the ARPANET. If you actually look at it, the internet community was the ARPANET community. It's just that the whole nature of the underlying technology changed out from underneath. And then you have the whole area of management and operations of the internet, which has had a different set of people involved. And then you have the whole commercialization track, which mm-hmm. I view is actually quite different from either of the other three. So when you look at that whole spectrum, many people are involved in it. And what I would simply point out is my own contribution, which I think was largely along conceptually along the technological track. I think the ideas for open architecture networking and for the protocols came from me, but I think that the community came from the original ARPA network, the operations and management, largely from government over many, many years, and now devolved into the private sector, and the commercialization totally really from the private sector with a little bit of an enabling push by government.
Bob, does it make you happy or uncomfortable? What do you think when I call you a pioneer? That's a sort of large metaphorical term that we throw around in our society, and we might think of Lewis and Clark or something like that. But it is a label that has been applied with utter seriousness to the work that you have done. How do you reflect on yourself as a groundbreaker?
Well, you know, there's an old story they tell about the settlers in the West, the way you told the difference between the pioneers and the settlers. Well, the pioneers were the ones with the arrows in their rear ends. I think most of the areas that I have chosen to work on in my technological career could be characterized as being very ambitious, breaking with the prevailing patterns of thought, mm-hmm. and really taking on challenges that I thought were just technologically very enticing and impactful.
Without naming names, did you make a lot of enemies along the way? Do you look back on this pioneering role and you say to yourself, I had more help than hindrance? Was it a struggle? Was it a gratifying kind of thing?
I think the reality is I had a lot more help than hindrance. Mm-hmm. The only things that I would point out is that we could have failed. I could have failed in a lot of the things that I attempted to do. Packet switching could have failed. The internet could have not made it. You know, I was involved in a number of other activities, not the least of which is what we attempted to do with the corporation that I set up after I left government to help foster the development of what's now known as the information superhighway, which seems to be taking hold in the public consciousness. Mm-hmm. But anytime you have a major success like that, and this is something I had not anticipated before, there is almost always somebody who comes out of the community that was involved that has some strong feeling of ownership or wanting to control it or whatever. And that's the one sort of bad feeling I have about what's gone on over the years, is it has never been creating enemies, but often people will come about and try and take more credit for something than perhaps it's worth.
Did you have a sense of personal and yet social ethics when you were working as a scientist in the development of information technology? Did you think more or less on a daily basis about the ethical and social implications of what you were doing?
Well, I would say, interestingly enough, that became a dominant factor once I got into the Defense Department. I know many people have a notion that defense doesn't worry about those things, but I think that was actually very much uppermost in my mind during all the time that I was there. And prior to joining defense, I viewed these opportunities more as technological opportunities and didn't spend a lot of time thinking about the social implications, but rather the technological promise. Today, I think my focus is almost totally directed at the social implications and how it can affect society, and having the technology, which I think I'm very strong in, mm-hmm. sort of derive from that. That never was the case when I was much younger.
Apropos of that, Bob Kahn, what is the most exciting kind of work that's going on in digital communications and information technology? We have government applications, we have education, there's a lot of exciting work going on in medicine. Scholars in the humanities are now deeply immersed in information technology. What is your sense of where the real action is, and what is its set of social implications?
Well, I think we're still a long way from the end of the whole computing and networking mm-hmm. train of evolution.
So it's not as good as it's ever going to get. I mean, you believe in this large term of called scientific progress.
I think it's still going to be perceived as a tip of the iceberg at this point. Computers are still big, monolithic things. You can't carry them around. They're not ubiquitous. They don't do most of the things that you'd like for them mm-hmm. to do for you. But even given the fact that that is going to continue, there is a problem that we've been dealing with that's very analogous to the internet problem that that we solved more than 20 years ago. The internet problem, I would say in a nutshell, was how do you take heterogeneous networks, make them all play together in an open architecture fashion such that computers could communicate through them? This is what we see in the web today and internet in general. Mm-hmm. There's the same kind of problem for informational resources of all kinds. You could think of them as digital libraries, but that's only one example. It's electronic commerce. It's virtually every application of informational technology. And what I've been working on in recent years is the development of something which I call a digital object infrastructure that enables heterogeneous information systems to interact with each other in a seamless way, just like the internet allowed heterogeneous networks to interact in a seamless way in this open architecture environment.
Now, again, to the uninitiated ear such as mine, what I hear you saying is that all information would be available to everyone all the time, instantly. Is that what I'm hearing in this?
What I'm saying is that this kind of architecture would enable that to be possible, subject to administrative controls that could be placed on that information by the people that created it. So the idea of a digital object is that it's really structured data according to a set of understood standards. It's really sequences of bits like audio and video and graphics and text and like all packaged together, such that the parties that create it can supply the terms and conditions for its use, and that those terms and conditions can be effectively managed throughout the lifetime of these objects in the network environment.
Here we are in the political season, Bob Kahn. Is it fair to say that cyberspace has a set of politics attached to it? Is cyberspace free of ideology in the sense of liberals and conservatives and this kind of claim and that kind of claim in our society? How do you think of it in those terms?
No, I think the feelings about it are as diverse as the feelings in any other realm of political discourse. There are very open-ended, let's try everything kinds of possibilities to let's enable the least we possibly can because we don't know what it will what its effects will be. Mm-hmm. I think there are strong economic interests that can be affected by the way information technology evolves and cyberspace evolves, and those interests are going to be prosecuted to the full extent of the parties who have the interests. Just how that plays out, I think, ultimately, in this country, is going to be a test for the Congress and a test for the courts. How it plays out around the world is actually going to be equally interesting, I expect.
Bob, I'm going to assume that you are something of inherently optimistic about the future of the kind of work that you have done as a cyberspace pioneer. Let's turn the coin over. Is there anything that keeps you awake at night? Anything that you worry about? Sort of the darkest fears category. When you think about the social implications of information technology?
I think the thing that is the least understood area of this whole infrastructure is how it can be harmed by people. That is to say, I mean, I believe that the benefits of worldwide informational infrastructure can be enormous in enabling us to reduce the barriers to economic growth in this country and productivity around the world, and enable a new kind of society with capabilities we never before thought were possible. On the other hand, as with any other infrastructure, if we become dependent on it, then we need to ensure that it's there when we need it, that it cannot be disrupted, taken away, or otherwise, destroyed or affected. And that's my one concern, that we don't know enough at this point to understand how to fully protect it against being really sabotaged or dismantled.
Bob, apropos of your comments about the future of cyberspace and information technology, your term is the architecture here. Who is it that should have what a proprietary role in the way information gets generated and exchanged in our society? You have people who generate it, people who consume it, people who are technologically controlling it. How do you speak to that?
Well, I think I would break it down into two different aspects. One is sort of authority chains in terms of what you can trust. The second idea has to do with ownership of the material and in particular, copyright and its application in the network environment.
Intellectual property.
Intellectual property is actually a fairly recent term that tends to be applied to both patent and copyright and a variety of matters. But I'm thinking about copyright in particular here as it pertains to the network environment. But you could include patent, too, because many people are now in the business of getting patents on processes for things that operate in the network environment. So maybe it's fair to talk about both. It is certainly the case that people who have ownership today in intellectual property have grave fears about the making available of that material in the network environment. It is very easy for a 28-year-old in Singapore to simply take somebody's intellectual property and replicate it to 6 billion people around the world at the press of a button on a keyboard.
Well, they do it with CDs already.
Well, they do pirate the CDs, but on the network environment, it's even easier because you don't have any physical things to do, and it can be all done by, you know, computational cycles, moving things around to everybody. The value of your property can therefore go from high to zero in a matter of seconds in the network environment. And I think we do not yet have foolproof mechanisms for dealing with that. My conjecture is that we will never have foolproof mechanisms for dealing with that any more than we have foolproof mechanisms for dealing with security of physical goods in the real world. But what we can do is, at ever-increasing expense, take precautions to ensure that the loss of economic revenue due to these kind of actions is minimized.
To come to another point on the spectrum that you're describing, Bob Kahn, do we need to worry about Big Brother? Was Orwell right? He may not have been aware of cyberspace, but how do you think about that?
Well, having been in government for many years, I don't think I would ever use the term worry about, because my perspective on government was that it's a set of people from our society trying to deal with what they perceive to be the most important issues from a national perspective.
It's benign.
No, I wouldn't say that either. What I would say is we need to be concerned about how we achieve the right mix of policy at the federal level, at the state and local levels, and in terms of what individuals and businesses can do. And that requires attention at every level. It is very easy for any one of those bodies to go off on a tangent that doesn't look at this thing from a national perspective. And the only way to formulate the national perspective is to get all the parties involved in trying to figure it out. I guess there is a concern about Big Brother, but certainly not a worry. It's just something that requires constant attention.
Bob Kahn, the buzz is that information technology will revolutionize and reform education, which has been subject to revolution and reform for these many years. What is your sense of that? Can we expect a sea change in the way we teach our young people because of information technology?
Well, President Clinton has made as one of his objectives to get every classroom connected to the internet by the year 2000. I think that's a laudable objective, especially since many classrooms don't even have telephones in them today, much less network connections. That's an important start. The problem is that even if you're connected to the network, it isn't clear to me how that helps with education in the large. And as we still have the need for highly qualified teachers, we need highly well-developed curriculums to deal with education, and most importantly, we need the software material in these systems that let people use the networks for educational purposes. I don't see how we're going to solve that problem short of simply budgeting whatever is necessary to either create it, buy it, sustain it, maintain it. And it seems to me that is the big issue that's facing us. Getting connected is merely the first critical step, but it is by far not the last step.
Final question, Bob Kahn. I'll give you an opportunity to be humble and proud at the same time. You are an honest-to-gosh, bona fide pioneer in information technology. What do you want to see happen to the legacy that you have helped to create and that in a very real and individual sense that you have created?
I think that the internet as we know it today is a very fragile creation. What I would hope is that we could find ways to build a stable foundation underneath the whole notion of open architecture networking so that free exchange of information among all the peoples of the world could be enabled, and that access to information in the form of these digital objects could be as free and easy as breathing air. So I think it's going to take work. The natural proclivity in many parts of the world is to be nervous or cautious or even paranoid about access to all of this information and communications. At a National Academy symposium recently, somebody said that the internet was the best single investment that the Defense Department ever made, and pointed to the breakdown of communism as a direct result. Now, I thought that was a little far-fetched, but in fact, the reality is this is a very powerful technology for social change, for people to learn about what's going on, and it can be threatening as well as powerful.
Bob, I want to thank you for taking this time on Soundings, and I want to thank our friends at the Smithsonian Institution, David Allison specifically, for helping to provide this opportunity for you to talk about your work. You are Robert Kahn. You're the president of the Corporation for National Research Initiatives. I won't even attempt to list all of the awards that you have won. Suffice to say that you are a pioneer in information technology. Bob Kahn, thank you so much. I certainly wish you well in your work.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was cyberspace pioneer Robert Kahn, a founder of the Internet who currently serves as president of the Corporation for National Research Initiatives. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, established in 1989 to honor innovative uses of information technology that benefit society. For more about the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, the worldwide website is http://innovate.si.edu. Audio cassettes of this discussion are available for $10 post-paid. Please write to us for a tape or send us your comments. The address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 839. That's program number 839. The address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, new fiction from writers Connie Mae Fowler and Jane Mendelsohn. They'll be here to read from and talk about their new books, Before Women Had Wings and I Was Amelia Earhart. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.